Research scientists tell us that race does not really exist. The people we call white or black or Asian contain hundreds, perhaps thousands, of genetically different groups which are masked by the false category of skin color. Yet when we look at health statistics in the United States, we find that African Americans, for example, suffer more lung cancer, heart disease, infant mortality, diabetes, and hypertension than white people, and black Americans are also more likely to get tuberculosis. If race does not exist, as the scientists say, what accounts for some of these differences? As part of NPR's continuing series on the history of slavery, Frank Browning has the second of two reports. He looks at how the confusions of race and science have led to mistrust, misdiagnosis, and poor health.
Let's start with tuberculosis. For most of the last 20 years, epidemiologist Andrew Moss of the University of California, San Francisco, has been tracking the origin and trail of several hot-button diseases. Earlier this year, I drove with him to the Tenderloin District in downtown San Francisco.
We're going to talk about a scientific investigation here. We're going to talk about looking at tuberculosis in the homeless population, 10,000 people or more. And this population in San Francisco, as in most American cities, is largely black Americans of African descent, or white Americans of European descent. Those two main groups, about 50-50. And when we look at tuberculosis in this population, what we find out is that most of it's in the Americans of African descent. That's who has the tuberculosis. And in fact, they have about five times the probability of getting tuberculosis as Americans of European descent, white people.
Stop right there. You probably heard that statement as a neutral piece of scientific reporting. Poor black people are more at risk for TB than poor whites. But Dr. Kamara Jones, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, hears something else.
Scientists in this country have been trained to collect our data by race, and we look at these race-associated differences in health status and in health outcomes, and we have books full of tables and graphs, and yet for the most part we don't go further to try to understand what the basis of those differences is.
Jones doesn't doubt that TB poses a big problem to poor African Americans, but she says that broad classifications like African American or black or white may prove more confusing than helpful.
In fact, the racial classifications that we think are so natural here in this country are poorly understood by people from other countries. People from Brazil come and they're really confused about how to classify people. And I take my own example. In this country, I'm black. In Brazil, I'm told I would be white. In South Africa, I would be colored. And yet my health risk, I'd have the same biology throughout, but my health risk would probably take on that of the group to which I was assigned, not be related so much to my genetics.
That's because different diseases reflect different interactions between biology, social status, and even social stigma associated with race. And the closer we look, the trickier it gets to sort out all these forces. TB, for example, has a very particular history that may link geography, genes, race, and politics. White people, Andrew Moss says, seem to have developed resistance to TB that Americans from Africa have not.
When you see an infectious disease, what you're seeing is the crossroads between history and biology. Tuberculosis is a disease that passed from cattle to men when cattle were domesticated, and it's passed through us in the thousands of years since then. And in particular, when we started living in cities, towns and cities, tuberculosis likes that because of the crowding, because it's a disease of breathing on people, and it worked through us very fast.
Essentially, every European got tuberculosis, and millions upon millions died, upwards of 10% per year in cities like London or New York.
So what we have left in Americans of European descent is the people who have protection against tuberculosis. What we have left is the people who have immunity, because the people who didn't are dead and their descendants never appeared. Now, is that not true of African Americans? There's an argument that it's not. Tuberculosis got to Africa late, probably brought there by European imperialists. White people, Northern Europeans, when they colonized the world, moved in a cloud of urban infectious diseases to which they had relative immunity. But they struck dead everybody around them and ahead of their advance. That's the history of imperialism. The history of imperialism is disease followed by soldiers.
Though the historical data is sketchy, Moss and other TB specialists believe that tuberculosis only came to Africa about 150 years ago. long after the slave trade brought the first black people here in chains. Nor were African Americans much exposed to TB until the last century when they began to move to northern cities. To develop natural resistance requires hundreds, perhaps thousands of years. The result, according to this theory, is that black people get TB more often because they have not had enough time to become resistant to this white man's disease. Harvard's Kamara Jones accepts that that is a plausible theory, but she says it's very hard to document historically. And she says it sets aside the fact that at least 3/4 of African Americans are also, genetically, European Americans, because from the beginning, so many black and white people were having sex with each other. Not surprisingly, all these issues are highly volatile, given the nation's race history, a fact that concerns epidemiologist Andrew Moss.
I think it's hard for people to hear anything which has a genetic explanation at the moment, particularly when it's associated with the great fault in American life, the black-white fault line. People are very afraid of bringing genetic ideas into any discussions of public health, whatever, in that, across that fault line, because of the tensions around it in this country, because of the history of the debate on race, and because of the perversion of genetic ideas earlier in the century.
These perverse genetic theories argued that black people were biologically flawed, and white doctors did often automatically diagnose any respiratory disease in a black patient as TB. Dr. Clive Callender, chief of surgery at Howard University in Washington, D.C., works in one of the most sensitive areas of race and science, human organ transplants. Every time he grafts a new kidney into a black patient, he faces a daunting challenge.
Those of African descent do 10 to 15% poorer after transplantation than all other ethnic groups. And that's when you look at Caucasians, you look at the Asian Pacific Islanders, you look at Hispanics, whatever group you want to look at. The bottom line is the group that stands out for being someone who does worse after transplantation than all other ethnic groups are those of African descent. And the big question is, why?
The likeliest answer, he says, is genetics, though not in the way most of us think about race and genetics.
If you look at our origins, and those of us who are black like me have come from Africa, and since civilization was born, began in Africa, we therefore have the most varied genetic patterns. And I think anthropologists have identified this. Immunogeneticists have also authenticated this. And so it seems to reason, therefore, because of the diversity, the heterogeneity, that this may be why we do more poorly after living-related transplants and after cadaver transplants, whether their donors are black or whether the donors are white.
Dr. Kenneth Kidd of the Yale University Medical School has done pioneering research tracking the genetic markers that distinguish population groups all over the world. Sub-Saharan Africans, he has shown, contain more genetic diversity than all the rest of the world's people combined. And, he says, that is particularly true of the natural antigens the body generates to fight off foreign invaders, including transplanted kidneys.
African populations have, by and large, a different set of antigens than do Europeans and Asians. And they have a very large number of different antigens. If the antigens are very different, it's almost certainly going to fail, or you need very major drug therapy.
Until very recently, most specialists attempted to protect organ recipients against antigen rejection with the anti-rejection drug, cyclosporin.
Don't get me started on cyclosporin.
Clive Callender, director of organ transplants at Howard University Medical School.
I think cyclosporin, in my view, is probably, after prednisone, the drug that is hardest on people of African descent.
Well, now that raises another interesting question.
It raises another interesting question. So what is that question?
Why a drug should act differently on one population versus another?
One of the things that we know for a fact now is that for cyclosporin, there is a wide variety, a wide difference in the way the GI tract absorbs cyclosporin. For those who are of African descent, for those who are diabetics, and for children.
Even those drugs that are more effective, Callender says, require twice the dosage to be well absorbed by African Americans as by white Americans. The great diversity among African-descended people requires very detailed research, not about race, but about individual genetically linked differences in metabolism and digestive hormones that affect how drugs are absorbed. Medically, scientifically, Callender and a growing number of doctors are arguing that the language of race has made health care worse for African Americans because the category itself hides the actual medical issues of diverse population genetics, of the thousands of population groups lumped together as black that are each different from the other.
My perspective is that race has no place in science. The problem is that institutional, organizational racism is here to stay. And wherever you go, you find organizational, institutional racism. For example, in the old days, okay, you castrated and decapitated us. Now, you just ignore us. We're invisible. I say something, and you don't hear me, but if a Caucasian person says the same thing, brilliant idea. Okay, so that's how racism plays out today.
Bluntly stated, because most organ donors and recipients are white and don't experience the particular problems of African-descended people, the special health issues that black physicians have long known about seldom won much interest from the elite research institutions concerned with, in this case, organ transplants. Only after molecular researchers like Yale's Kenneth Kidd and others documented the genetic diversity inherent in African peoples did these black health issues win serious attention. Harvard's Dr. Kamara Jones spends much of her time sorting out the intertwining strands of race and racism. Specifically, she's examined the effects of race stigma on one of the primary diseases affecting African Americans, hypertension, or high blood pressure. Doctors have known since the 1930s that black people here suffer worse hypertension than whites.
They've adjusted in their statistics for income, for body weight, for salt intake, and yet there's always been this little bit of excess hypertension in black folks compared to white folks that hasn't been explained, and then people throw up their hands and say, oh, it must be genetic.
Yet, given what we know about the enormous genetic diversity of African Americans, the very diversity that makes organ transplants difficult, it didn't make sense to Jones that so many people could share a single genetic trait that could explain such widespread hypertension.
The way I looked at it was by looking at all the blood pressures, the full distribution of blood pressures, and compare those black to white. And it's very interesting. At the youngest age groups, 5 to 14-year-olds comparing blacks to whites, there are no differences at all in blood pressure distributions. But when you compare the black distributions in middle and older ages, it looks like from no difference in childhood, the way that blood pressure increases with age, and it does increase with age for both black people and white people in this country, the way it increases with age appears to be faster for black people than white people by about 10 years by the time you get to middle age and older age.
In the United States, simply being black appears to bring on faster aging of the cardiovascular system than being white. Even though there's no genetic uniformity among all the black people, and hypertension does not appear to be uniformly heightened among African-descended people outside of the United States. As Jones sees it, that points toward the social situation of those Americans who are called black.
We have one country, but two groups. They have two different social definitions, which result in two different kinds of life experiences that have two different rates of increase in blood pressure with age. This suggests that there's some accelerated aging with regard to blood pressure, and it's an interesting research question to then go on and say, well, perhaps this accelerated aging goes beyond blood pressure and might affect all of the systems, and it might account for some of these black-white differences that we haven't been able to examine. Now, the question is, why do you have the accelerated aging? And my hypothesis is that it's because of the chronic stressors of racism.
The relationship of stress and hypertension has long been established. But figuring out how to calculate particular stresses of racism, independent of diet and other factors, is far harder. In one survey of nurses, Jones asked white and black women how often they thought about their race.
In one with a very large group of white women, 50% of them say that they never think about their race, and only 3% think about their race once a day or more frequently. In another large group of black women, 50% of them say they think about their race either once a day, once an hour, or constantly, with 23% saying they think about their race constantly. It's very telling that there are some people for whom race is so pertinent in a daily or constant way, and some people who don't even consider that they have a race. They never think about their race.
That awareness of being different is not restricted to skin color. It also marks people who have a foreign name, live with a same-sex lover, or speak with a hillbilly accent. But skin color, and in particular blackness, is in this country the most indelible marker of difference, a form of difference which is all but inescapable. It is, she says, the dailiness of that reality that forces black Americans to be constantly conscious of their race. Dr. Janet Mitchell, an obstetrician at Woodhull Public Hospital in Brooklyn, speaks of another sort of tension that is never very far away, a sense of always being under suspicion.
I know even among my own peer group that it's not the same when they say they're taking a day off to go to the doctor as one of their white colleagues, you know, because there's still the stereotype in the back of the minds of their bosses that they're slacking off because they're going to look at me and think that I'm a slack off and that I'm not as talented and that I'm not as good, and therefore everything that I do is going to be suspect and not going to be looked at and evaluated equally. That's stress.
That, I would say, I mean, I would use the term allostatic load then to describe the physiologic response to those kinds of pressures.
Dr. Bruce McEwen, a senior neuroscientist at Rockefeller University, has spent the last decade analyzing how long-term unrelieved stress affects the body. The chronic secretion of stress hormones like cortisol and other corticosteroids, he says, leads to a number of diseases, including immune failure, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, depression, and metabolic imbalance.
If you have elevated cortisol, you usually have elevated levels of adrenaline, which is the other major stress hormone, and sooner or later, the combination of elevated cortisol and elevated adrenaline will also cause insulin to go up. And if you have chronically elevated cortisol and chronically elevated adrenaline, insulin secretion may go up chronically, and then you have a condition which, in as it gets worse, becomes what people call type 2 diabetes.
Research breakthroughs in just the last half dozen years have shown McEwen and many other investigators exactly how the accumulation of stress seems to provoke a hormonally based chain response within the body.
I would say, you know, to use our terminology, you have an elevated allostatic load as a result of this cumulative effect of these different experiences that you just simply can't let go. Because of these, you know, your perceptions of how people are looking at you and regarding you and treating you.
Isolating and calculating the health effects of stress produced by a race-divided society will not be easy. But increasingly, scientists are finding that they must rethink how they look at disease, how to separate the real and diverse groups of people who are genetically different from each other, and how to identify and treat the stress-based diseases created by social prejudice. In the world of hard science, the idea of race seems destined for extinction. But in the clinical wards, the consequences of race thinking, of conscious and unconscious assumptions about superior and inferior people, remains all around us. In 1795, a German scientist, Johann Friedrich Blumenbach, a man famed for his commitment to enlightened reason, set about reorganizing the categories of various species, including human beings. Blumenbach espoused no overt belief in the superiority of any single race, but in explaining his theory of human origins, he identified white people as the oldest humans and then gave them the name Caucasian. He wrote,
"I've taken the name of this variety from Mount Caucasus, both because its neighborhood, and especially its southern slope, produces the most beautiful race of men, and because in that region, if anywhere, it seems we ought, with the greatest probability, to place the original form of mankind."
Declaring the human beauty of his own preference the most beautiful of all, and therefore the closest in resemblance to God, the old German naturalist set the very terms for unconscious race superiority. His terminology not only distorted our actual biological origins, on grounds that had absolutely nothing to do with science, it established a scientific justification for white superiority that has plagued the Western idea of race ever since.
For NPR News, I'm Frank Browning.
Our series on science and race was edited by Sharon Green as part of NPR's collaboration with the PBS documentary project.